listening to The Discovery Pod, a podcast dedicated to conversations with leaders in the social profit sector. Discover the origin stories of CEOs, founders, and other senior leaders and learn from them so you can accomplish what is most important. Now, on with the show with your host, Douglas Nelson.
Hello and welcome to The Discovery Pod, Conversations with Social Profit Leaders. I'm your host, Douglas Nelson, and on today's episode, we have Rita Roy. Rita is the CEO and president of MasterCard Foundation, the largest foundation in Canada, the fifth largest in the world, but most importantly, MasterCard Foundation seeks a world where everyone has the opportunity to learn and prosper. Rita, in our conversation, explores the development of the MasterCard Foundation, the strategies that they employ to work with communities in sub-Saharan Africa and across Canada, particularly in Canada's north, that starts with co-creation, listening, and asking the right questions, and developing the answers with those that they seek to serve. Rita shares her own journey as a leader, reflects on the mentorship that she's received, and paints a picture of what excellence looks like in the leadership of our social profit sector. If you're interested in developing your own leadership skills and the skills of those around you, you're going to want to listen to this episode with Rita Roy.
Welcome, Rita.
Hi, Doug. Thank you so much for having me.
Rita, it is so great to have you on the Discovery Pod. We've been really looking forward to the conversation. For our listeners who aren't familiar, though I suspect most of them are, could you tell us a little bit about the work of the MasterCard Foundation and what it means to seek a world where everyone has the opportunity to learn and prosper?
Thank you for opening up. So the MasterCard Foundation, first and foremost, is a Canadian foundation. It was created in 2006 when MasterCard, the company, became a public company. But the company did something very unusual, and it set up the foundation in Toronto, in a very global, multicultural city. It set out two areas of work or charitable purposes, one to really advance education, and the other to extend financial services to the poor. And the third, probably most unusual thing they did was they made the foundation completely independent and separate from the corporation. So our foundation has its own board of governors or board of directors, its own management team. We have our own policies and we make our own decisions. And early on, the foundation board at the time, and soon after I got there, we set out to really define our purpose. And we did set a vision of a world where all have the opportunity to learn and prosper. And when you ask what it means many things. First and foremost, it means listening and understanding where communities are, if they're here in Canada, particularly around Indigenous communities, where young people are, if we're walking somewhere in Rwanda or in Ghana, really understanding what people's aspirations are, what their dreams are, the problems they live with, what their ideas are for how to solve those problems. So it starts there, listening, understanding, and then thinking about what tools, what resources we have, which could be brought to bear. But always asking first, how could we create solutions together? What is the outcome we're seeking to achieve? And so it's a work which in many ways, it's not work, it's a labor of love, right. It's a calling. And it's most of it's about building community and building trusted partnerships.
With the capacity that the MasterCard Foundation has and the track record that you've built over the last number of years, I wonder how you balance that tension of moving into a community or working with a group and saying, we're excited, we've got momentum, let's get to work, and holding back to listen as you're working with a new community or new groups around the world. How do you as the CEO balance that urgency with the commitment to be listening?
That's a phenomenal question. And I think it's a tightrope you walk every single day, every single day. And in many ways, it's tempered by also looking at history and looking at the literature and understanding. I think we have to take stock when we look at the world of philanthropy and the world of, particularly world of development. There are many examples of what not to do. Mm. One of the things not to do is to imagine that we know the answers, or we got that solution, or we understand what the problem is. And so you really have to temper yourself and discipline yourself on that. That said, the people we work with, they have a sense of urgency. They would like the problem solved yesterday. Young women who want to be in school years ago, who've missed that opportunity. Parents who want their children to go to school. Somebody wants to start a business or grow their business and needs support. And they have a sense of urgency, which we probably cannot even fully understand. And so it's always a balancing act, but it has to start by really understanding before we can run.
Right. And you said the mistake that we see it in the sector and the world of international development. We see it right across our sector and every area, that assuming that we know the answer. I'm sure in your work, sometimes it's you show up and you don't even really know the question to ask. It's your presence is the start of the conversation. How do you approach that and encourage your colleagues to approach those situations when you're entering a new area of work?
Well, a couple of things we try to follow. We're not a perfect organization. We're an organization also of people who've come from vast, different professions, different walks of life. But there are two things which we hold dear at the foundation. We have a number of values. So I spoke about one already, which is about listening. But the second, in pursuit of impact, we have a word which we use. It's called co-creation. Mm-hmm. And so when we enter a conversation or in a country, in a community, and we're discussing with, could be with elders here in Canada and Indigenous communities. It could be with leaders or other kinds of community leaders if we're in different countries in Africa. Let's say we're speaking about education. And yes, we have seen different models, different ways of solving problems. But we really need to come into that conversation to understand where people are, how leaders perceive and understand problems. They've seen this before. They've also seen this before, and we have to recognize that. And so we use a term called co-creation, which means we come together, we understand problems together, but then we also try to start identifying problems together. So it's a process which brings, I think, better solutions where everyone feels ownership, and therefore we're accountable, jointly accountable for the outcomes we're pursuing. It also means that there's a willingness to learn, that sometimes even with the best research, the best set of assumptions, once you get going into implementation, you realize perhaps some of these assumptions weren't well calibrated. We've got to pivot. We've got to change. Something's not working. And so when you build trust at the outset and you're able to have conversations to say, I think we need some work here, or we need some work there, we need to pivot, we need to change, we need to adapt, or we need to start again. Mm-hmm. That's part of what partnership looks like, particularly right. Co-creation approach.
And I'm sure you've learned a lot of lessons along the way in developing that model of co-creation. I'm curious if you've got a radar for when you feel like something, maybe the assumptions weren't quite correct, or maybe we're on the right path, but we've stepped off to the left or the right a little bit. How have you developed that sense over time, both as a leader yourself, but also as a very significant foundation?
Early on in my career, I had a wonderful boss who became my mentor. She probably wouldn't like me to say this on air, but she's about 75 today, and I want to be like her one day. But she just instilled in me. When I joined as a young manager in a large corporation, she said, I know you're smart, I know you went to school, but you're going to have to learn that you've got a lot to learn. So the first thing you need to do when you enter a room, particularly a large meeting or in a different kind of setting, just be quiet, listen, watch, learn to ask questions. And sometimes it's the question that opens up a conversation. And so I don't know, but I certainly learned everything Margaret taught me over the years. And I'm still learning how to refine that every single day. I don't have it down all the time. But when you enter a conversation and when we're in discussion, I think we try to do several things, create an atmosphere where it's regardless of who, maybe I'll have to do this again, but let me try and explain this. When you enter a conversation where we're trying to solve, some of these problems are difficult problems. Sometimes they're sensitive issues. I think the first job is to also try and create an environment where all of us are coming to the table together so that focus is not each other. The focus is the problem we're trying to solve or the opportunity which we're trying to expand. And to create an environment where there can be debate, discussion, disagreement, And I always tell our team, as the foundation, we've got to work extra hard to take the power dynamic out of the room. Mm-hmm. We're interested in solving problem A or problem B. And if we're in a community, if we're in, as I recently was in Alberta, visiting the Blackfoot Confederacy, we're on Team Blackfoot. We're here to focus on what it means to help young people transition from post-secondary education into work. But it's engaging. And you pick up very quickly when a conversation isn't really getting to the heart of the matter.
Right.
And sometimes it's up to us to say, I don't think we're really touching in on the right things, or maybe we need to step back. And are we approaching this in the right spirit, or in some cases in the right way? And what is wonderful is when you listen, especially if you listen to young people, I don't know whether it's because there are no filters or what, but people tell you straight to say, I think you're looking at this the wrong way, or what you think is the real risk or is the real problem is you're not even close. The real issue is sitting over here. And we've had that in a number of ways. I remember, if I could go on a bit, when we worked with an organization when I first began at the MasterCard Foundation, and we were doing some work in Morocco. And the focus was really about enabling young people to access financial services, especially credit. And it was known in those days, microfinance was known as microcredit.
Right.
There's lots of research which said, yes, people need loans to start little businesses, etc. 6 months into the whole thing, nobody wanted a loan. They all wanted savings accounts. And that was when you thought, let's change. Let's pivot. Mm-hmm. Let's listen more closely to what right. they need.
Muhammad Yunus was right about a lot of things, but maybe just not that one thing in Morocco.
That's right. Perhaps, but that ended up being a very fruitful program, but also just rich in terms of learning and how to engage young people.
One of the things that's really fascinating to me in looking at the history of the MasterCard Foundation is starting with such a wide range of opportunities. You could take on any issue, any causes anywhere in the world as an organization. And anyone that has been watching the foundation has seen you really narrow the focus. So over the last number of years, and you described your process, which is to enter the room and listen at the same time, narrowing focus. How has those two things worked together to change the outcomes and the impacts that the foundation's able to make in the world?
Thank you. I think it's well put. There was probably three early decisions which were made when the foundation was just getting on its way. And those are decisions which I look back on and I think, wow, they've kept us on the path. Hmm. So clearly, from the outset, we had these two areas of focus around education and financial inclusion. But the founding board at the time said, we really need to make sure that we fully realize the opportunity that we have at this foundation. And that's going to require focus. Let's really think about where in the world we should focus. And the data led us to Africa, more specifically sub-Saharan Africa, because we could see at that time, only 25%, perhaps even less than that, of the population had access to a savings account. So it spoke volumes about the millions of people who were excluded from financial services, just so important in order to participate in the economy mm-hmm. and to make a living. We saw that at the time, a very small percentage of young people who should be in secondary school were in secondary school. Today, it's better, but it's only at 44%. And when you get to higher education, 9% of young people who should be in higher education are even completing higher education. Mm-hmm. So the data spoke about where there could be a huge opportunity for impact. The second thing the board said was, we could do many things, but if we really want to understand impact, change, economic transformation, then we need to be prepared to go a long mile, to walk that journey, take a long-term view. And we're a private organization. We have that opportunity. We have that ability. And the third thing they said was, think about scale. Think about scale. Not necessarily doing thousands and thousands and thousands of small pilots. But there's a role for that. But we have a pool of resources which we could really deploy and go deep and go long. And so when you see something working, take that next step and ask the question, how do we expand education? How do we improve quality? How do we get from 1,000 people to 10,000? How do you go from 10,000 to 100,000? Think in terms of design that enables access.
Those three decisions, those three conversations at the start of the foundation are ones that I would wish every foundation that we have the chance to work with here at the Discovery Group took the time to think through their answers to those questions, because the answers will be different for different organizations. But you've really touched on what is at the heart of being an effective funder over time. In that last answer, you talked a little bit about the work that MasterCard Foundation does in sub-Saharan Africa. You're also a very significant funder of work in Indigenous communities here in Canada, and I'm hoping you could take a few minutes and walk us through some of the great work that you're undertaking in that area.
Well, I'd love to do that. Thank you. So we began our work with Indigenous communities in 2017, right at the time when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had published and issued its recommendations, when there was a real moment, a moment for our country to really reflect on how we go forward and how we go forward in a truly inclusive, empowering manner. And we saw the opportunity with education. And so the process began by listening. And we did a lot of consultations with communities, but especially with young people. And that's how a program, which we call LAV, began. In fact, the name, if you were to look at its logo, all of that was designed with input of young people, and they really led the way. And so this is an initiative which started out somewhat modestly because we were learning and we were working out in the Yukon and in British Columbia with two institutions who had strong ties to Indigenous communities. And the focus was on post-secondary education and young people's access to that education and their transition from that. From that time, we've expanded significantly. So in the last 5 years, we have partners across the country, from the east to the west, north and south, and especially very interested now in the northern part of the countries. But the work starts by engaging communities to ask them, where are their young people? What would they like to see in terms of access to education? And what we're hearing often, very consistently, is we'd love for young people to have opportunity. Many young people speak about wanting to stay in their community. They speak about careers they'd like to see in agriculture, in food systems, in addressing climate change, the creative sector. They're working off interesting ideas, but they need support to expand that. We also see a huge need for and the resonance when it comes to language and the revitalization of Indigenous languages and what it means to culture, to self-esteem, and to moving forward. So whether we're working with the Blackfoot Confederacy, whether we're working with a university like Laval University, which is working with its communities, whether it's a partnership between Queen's University and the Winnebago Health Authority in Northern Ontario, you see similar themes around development and skills and education for young people, but really being driven by their interests and also support for institutions, whether it's the Seven Generations Institution, focusing on what they need to be successful to enable their young people to succeed. So we think about impact in probably three different ways. One, young people themselves and how they see that their progress, how they describe their progress. So not just the numbers, which we care about, certainly, the numbers of young people completing education and so forth, but it's the young people, it's also the institutions which serve them, that they have the resources, the capabilities, the networks to be able to develop new programs, to be able to continue to meet the needs of their community. And ultimately, what we're looking for is a transformation in our education system, in our ability to bring together, enable young people, especially young entrepreneurs from Indigenous communities, to participate more fulsomely in the economy. Mm-hmm. So we made an initial commitment of 10,000 young people. We're well past that, and we've set a new goal of 100,000 young people from Indigenous communities by 2030. And we have made a significant financial commitment of $500 million towards that goal. So we're pleased. We started modestly, and we're on our way to scale.
That's a really powerful journey you're sharing there, and just an incredible investment and something that is so important. Listening to you talk and knowing the number of organizations that you've worked with over the course of the last number of years to get to this point, I'm interested in hearing your perspective. As a relatively young foundation, we still hear in our travels across the sector, particularly in post-secondary institutions, that the opportunity to work with or be funded by the MasterCard Foundation is something of a badge of honor. It shows credibility on the part. It shows a credibility on the part of the institution that they are worthy or are able to be a partner with MasterCard. It's a big deal. And I'm interested in hearing what you've learned or what you've observed in working across the post-secondary sector in Canada and how those partnerships work best.
First of all, thank you for saying that. I think credit goes actually to my colleagues, and it goes to the people with whom we work at all of these institutions. When we enter a partnership, I'll just give you my bias. I look for certain things. I know there's so many organizations which are doing outstanding work or doing important work. What I really look for is, at the leadership level, are leaders who are also listening and really seeking to understand, and leaders who lean in when things aren't going right, when there are real challenges. And you observe that in so many ways, in their interactions when we're in community, how people are responding, the kinds of things that they're willing to put on the table. It's not just about vulnerability, but when we haven't worked well, or we haven't done as much, or we haven't done something to the best of our abilities. But it's really that sincerity of wanting to drive an outcome, but recognizing that it's that outcome can only be achieved when others come on the journey. And so I see that. I think partnerships, like so many things, they're really tested, not just when times are good and it sounds great and we're announcing or launching a new initiative, but it's really tested when things don't go to plan and people are able to gather quickly. And yes, there may be disappointment, there may be some venting, but then really the focus is on how do we get it back on track? What do we need to do? And in some cases, what do we need to change about how we're working? And I learned so much from leaders who are like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real staying power. And that's how trust is built. And that's the basis for long-term relationships between institutions and between leaders.
Right. You referenced earlier the encouraging your team to try and reduce the power dynamic as the funder when you're working in community. Working with large institutions, it's a little different. And I would imagine those conversations are different. We can save that for the after podcast conversation. But as an organization that really is committed to that concept of co-creation, working with large institutions where co-creation is a really difficult thing for them to do sometimes, or an underused muscle for a lot of leaders, what works in terms of encouraging those institutions to join you in that path of co-creation?
I think it does require several things. Number one, I think it's hopefully we find the right champions within those large institutions.
Right.
It really helps when you have either the most senior leadership level or within those teams, people who are also looking for a different way of working that works, that actually works, and who are both curious about that, and they have a willingness, just as we do, a willingness to be, and a readiness and an openness to be influenced, to try something. Mm-hmm. I remember working with three universities here in Canada who are well-known, large, extremely accomplished, highly respected. And the first time we came together to work on, and they became members of the MasterCard Foundation Scholars Program, and we brought them into a room together and said, now, you're going to be working together. You're actually going to help each other on your respective proposals and applications, because we want to make sure that we're bringing the best out of each institution, that there is a lot of sharing about what we're going to be learning. And this program was focused on the continent of Africa and identifying highly vulnerable, just so talented young people and providing an opportunity to learn. First meeting we had, we didn't call it co-creation, then we had some other word, collaboration. There was a lot of surprise. The second meeting, we were catching on today. Oh my goodness. I can't imagine not working with these three organizations and how incredibly helpful they have been, mm-hmm. not just to us, but to each other. So I think it comes back to people, mm-hmm. painting a vision in some part about this is where we're headed, but achieving our goal is extremely important, but how we go about it, equally important.
I think there is something so critically important in the entire world of philanthropy, particularly as it relates to granting. It's not just what you grant to, it's how you do it and how you're meeting the community. And if you can bring three prestigious universities together and get them working together, you're doing something very right.
Yes, no, they are. And, but they were, fortunately, were terrific universities, but they did say, this is an unusual way of working.
Right. How is being a foundation acting across the globe or in, outside of the Canadian borders, how does being based in Canada impact the work of MasterCard Foundation?
Well, I think in many ways, it's been very helpful to us. Oftentimes people, when they see the name, they think, oh, you must be an American foundation. And then I walk through how we were founded, the genesis of the foundation, and that we're here rooted in Canada. And so it's been very helpful in several ways. One, I think still a huge respect. Canada, around the world, people recognize that there's a sensibility, there's an understatement in terms of how we work. There's a kindness in how we engage. I think that always helps in any situation. That's number one. I think there's also an understanding that we're a country which also is dealing with our own challenges, you know, and our own history. And that we're not here to impose or instruct or pretend in any way that we have the answer. Mm-hmm. I think it's very much in keeping with the sensibility of the foundation as well, in terms of how we work. And now, as you know, as a private organization, we are independent of any type of ideology or politics. We're just interested in that vision, mm-hmm. opportunity for all to learn and prosper. And the underscoring is on the all, which means we look at who's excluded. So I think that's kept us on the straight and narrow, as it were, in terms of how we work. Yeah.
Right. Well, as a leader of the organization, certainly you are a person of prominence and you received a number of honorary degrees. And our listeners who've joined us through our conversation today will also hear a genuine humility in how you talk about both your own work and the work of the foundation. Accolades and accomplishments are not always the measure of what success looks like in people. And so looking back over your career, what are you most proud of and what do you consider to be your own personal greatest achievements?
I would never have imagined if somebody had asked me this as a young person that I'd be doing what I'm doing today. I would have loved to be involved in something like this, but I would never have imagined my life leading an organization like this. So for that, I'm extremely grateful, extremely grateful. When I think about what I'm proudest of, it's so hard to pinpoint. I still see so much more work ahead, so much more to learn. I can say I'm extremely grateful for the people who mentored me. I'm grateful for a mother who sacrificed for me. I'm grateful for leaders that I've met along the way who have taught me. Just that they've taught me whether it was about how they perceive the world, how they ask questions, how they engage with others. I am proud, though, of the work of the foundation. I'm proud that there's trust in us as a partner. And I know that trust has to be earned every single day in terms of how we show up. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that the work, and we're still in many ways, as you said, a young organization, that we are building the foundation of the foundation to do great things, yeah, as we move forward, but to also always recognize we're an organization that heavily dependent on the partnership of others. Mm-hmm. So this is not about claiming credit. If anything, credit goes to everybody else who actually do the hard work of implementing programs. So I would just leave it at that.
Well, you've mentioned mentors a few times as we've gone through this conversation. And as an organization committed to learning and asking questions, finding the right questions to ask, as CEO and president, when you need to turn to someone for advice, who do you turn to?
Oh, wow. There's so many different people in Moments. So I have a tremendous relationship, and I'm very fortunate. I have a tremendous relationship with my board and the leaders on my board. But it's also interesting. I've also mentored young people. And sometimes, at a moment, I'll call somebody. Might be a student, might be a young person. I'm thinking of one in particular who's a physician today, but I met her before she went to university. And I'll ask her, and I'll say, what do you think about ABC? How do you approach this problem? What would you say? Sometimes I think about facing particularly a difficult conversation or a difficult decision. I remember the words of one of my mentors, Mark, the woman I told you about. Mm-hmm. And she would always say two things. If you're about to make a decision and it's going to be consequential, wait. Don't rush. Wait. Second thing she used to say, and she still says it periodically to me, she said, Rita, try to make new mistakes. Try to make new ones every day. But that's how you're going to learn. And that's something I try to tell our team. I mean, people are so focused, and I have a lot of high achievers in my organization. And they said, what do you mean make new mistakes? Let's try not to make mistakes. I said, no. Sometimes mistakes are really quite helpful. Mm-hmm. Really helpful to us. Yeah. But there are many people I can think about who've helped me.
Make new mistakes. That's a good slogan, I think. I really appreciate you sharing that. As we come to the end of our conversation, I get to ask my favorite question.
What is it?
What are you looking forward to?
I'm actually looking forward to more impact. One of the things which encourages me every day, it's like oxygen, is that the number of young people that I meet who talk about where they're going, what they're doing, what they've learned, and I know we've overcome so much already, whether they're at school here in Canada, at one of those universities, whether they've just won a prize or they've just received some funding for a project. And it never fails to give me energy and to give me boost, just a boost to say, we're on the right track. We're doing something right. And so I just look forward to seeing where they will end up and what they will do. That's what I'm looking forward to. And just knowing that there is a ripple effect, a ripple impact in the work that we're doing. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of that in future. And I'm looking forward to continuing to learn. I don't want to say I'm looking forward to making more new mistakes, but just growing and learning.
Yeah. Rita, it is such a pleasure to have the chance to speak with you. As a leader in our sector, you are an example for others to follow in terms of managing purpose so well, of the purpose of your organization and the approach for how your organization does its work. It has been so incredible to watch MasterCard Foundation expand its reach and expand its impact. And we're really looking forward to what is to come. We'll sit off to the sidelines and watch you continue to do your great work in the months and years to come. Thanks for being on the Discovery Pod today.
Thank you so much, Doug. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Discovery Pod. Be sure to tune in next week for another inspiring and informative conversation. Don't forget to visit our website, thediscoverygroup.ca, for more resources. If you like what you just listened to, please subscribe and tell a friend about it. Until next time, keep working to make your organization exceptional.